What a great title, The Last Man Who Knew Everything, The Life and Times of Enrico Fermi, the father of the nuclear age. First, why that title?
That title was suggested by a couple of his former students who I interviewed as part of the research for this. And it's because he knew everything about physics. He really did. He was the last person who could really see physics as an integrated whole. He was also really great as a theorist and really great as an experimentalist. And that is an incredibly rare combination. So the combination of those two things, the fact that he contributed to virtually every area of physics and the fact that he was both an experimentalist and a theorist, makes him the last man who knew everything, at least about physics.
Yeah. What's your interest in this?
Well, my father was a particle physicist. And when he died, he left behind a bunch of papers. And I was going through those papers, and I started reading about Enrico Fermi's time in Chicago, an essay that had been written by a friend of his. And I was just fascinated. The guy is a fascinating man. He lived a dramatic life. He had such a great impact across all different areas of science, and impact that lasts till today. So I decided I wanted to read a biography of him, a real biography. I went to the library, and the last biography at that point, this was 2013, had been written in 1970. And I thought, well, that's ridiculous. You know, this is a guy who's so important. Every little town in Italy has a street or a square named after him. He was a central figure in the Manhattan Project, a central figure in physics. His legacy set the agenda for physics for the next 30 years, and yet we've forgotten about him. That seems unfair. So I decided to fix that.
We do have a Fermi National Laboratory.
Absolutely, we do.
But I wonder how many of us appreciate what the name behind that is.
I think very few people really know what Fermi did, and I think, well, I don't know how many people know. People around here, of course, know about Fermi National Lab. I don't know whether people around the country really do.
Okay, so tell me what he did. In layman's terms, from a particle standpoint, what did Fermi do?
Well, he conducted the first sustained controlled nuclear chain reaction under the stands of the disused football stadium at the University of Chicago. That's probably what he's most famous for.
Unbeknownst to the school president, you wrote. I didn't realize that.
Yes, the school. They were afraid to tell the school president because they thought he would say, no, you can't do that.
Yeah.
But they were very confident that it wouldn't blow up.
Yeah, sure. So this is over at the University of Chicago. What year was that?
That was in 1942.
And where was that in the evolution of the atomic bomb?
Well, that was sort of relatively early on. Los Alamos hadn't been established yet. Los Alamos was established in 43. But this experiment that was done by Fermi and his colleagues was really the proof of the concept of a chain reaction, which underlies the concept both of a nuclear reactor and a nuclear bomb.
And you say they were confident that it would happen, but in fact, they had never been able to actually get a pile of fissionable material to go active like that?
They had never gotten there before, but they had a big enough space underneath the stands, and actually what's a rackets court. It's often called a squash court, but it's a rackets court. They had enough space to put enough uranium in one place to get the thing to work.
Where did they get the uranium?
They got it from lots of different places. There were stockpiles in Africa that they were able to get a hold of. There were stockpiles in Canada they were able to get a hold of. This was the first time that people needed industrial size uranium. And there was a lot of uranium that they had to bring in for this.
So they have this behemoth of a graphite, right?
Yes.
Is that like the stuff of a pencil?
Exactly. You know, it's bricks of graphite, just like a pencil, except much purer.
And by what dimensions have we stacked this?
We're stacking
27 feet, isn't it?
27 feet high and, you know, 20 by 20 wide.
So it's a gigantic block of graphite.
Yeah.
And then they bore holes in that.
They bored holes and stuck uranium slugs inside the pile.
And what was the purpose of that? What is the relationship between these two materials?
Well, the graphite slows the process down enough so that the neutrons can actually split the uranium atom. If the neutrons are going too fast, they sometimes bypass the nucleus.
Right. And three great discoveries by Fermi. One of them was slow neutrons,
neutron, yeah, exactly.
Okay, but I'm still interested in the university not going kablooey. So you've got this giant block of graphite, and you've got these radioactive slugs in there, right?
Right.
So then how do they control that? What happens? Talk a little bit
well,
about that.
Well, I mean, the first thing that they did was they as they were building it, they monitored every day how far the reaction would go. So they could plot on a line when the thing would go critical. So they knew that at level 57, I think it would go critical.
Oh, right. So they put in a layer of graphite with the holes with the uranium in there.
And then they would test.
And then
it.
Do another one. They could tell that there's more and more neutrons that are being liberated.
Exactly.
It's getting warmer, but it's not critical yet.
Exactly. And they had control rods made out of cadmium. They had discovered that cadmium absorbs neutrons very effectively, and so the result of that was they would put the, if things went bad, they would stick these cadmium rods in and slow the reaction down. And if that didn't work, they had liquid cadmium buckets up on the top, and a couple of guys would douse the whole thing with liquid cadmium.
So what could go wrong? But wasn't it there though that they also had a rubber and shell built around it too?
They had a rubber balloon that they thought they would need because they thought that they might need to evacuate the pile from as much air as possible, pump a vacuum out. But it turned out, given what they were discovering as they built the pile, that they didn't really need that, and they never really closed that up.
So at the 56th or 57th layer, as Fermi predicted, calculated, the pile go. What's the vocabulary here?
The pile went critical.
Went critical.
Yeah.
And then what happens?
And then it went critical about 3:30 on December 2nd, 1942. And they watched the power increase very slowly. Now, this was a very, very low power experiment. It was about a half a watt at the peak. But it took about 28 minutes for it to go to about a half a watt. And they were listening to every time a neutron was released, the counters would click, and they were hearing the clicks go faster and faster and faster and faster in an exponential way. And at one point, one of Fermi's colleagues, Leona Libby, says, "When do we get scared?" And Fermi waved her off because he was busy concentrating on the instruments. But then finally, he had decided that, you know, he had demonstrated it. There was enough recording of the reaction, so he called it off and said, "Stop it!" And they threw the rod.
So we can control a sustained reaction.
Yes, exactly.
And if we can do that, what can we do?
If we can do that, then we can do two things. Number one, we believe that we can create a real chain reaction explosively, which is uncontrolled, and which was the next step in making the bomb. But the other thing that was very important was that this process produces plutonium through a very complex series of reactions in the uranium. It produces plutonium, which is actually heavier than uranium. And the theory was, and it turned out to be correct, that plutonium would also be a good material to use for a nuclear bomb. And they weren't sure that uranium would be good or that they would be able to use the uranium, so it was very important to find a way to produce plutonium.
Did this predict the ability to harness nuclear power for energy purposes?
Absolutely.
And did they think about that at the time, or was this a bomb project?
No, I think that Fermi certainly thought that this would be used for electricity in the future. He also thought that it would be used for radioisotopes, which they are today. I mean, there was a real need for radioisotopes for cancer therapy and for diagnostics.
Did they have a sense, though, that what we are doing here – I know you write about this in the book, but so then it goes critical. Hooray. But was there sort of a dark cloud over that?
Absolutely. There were people who – you know, the people there understood that what they had proven was that, you know, man could make a weapon that would blow up cities. And,
what did Fermi think about that?
You know, he was never really open about that. You know, you have to guess from some of the comments he made and some of his behavior later on in the Manhattan Project. I think he felt it was very important to do this before the Germans got the bomb, and that was the key factor in his thinking. But he also thought that it was inevitable that this thing would be used, and with dreadful destructiveness, and he wasn't happy about that.
Hmm. What kind of guy was he?
He was a very narrowly focused guy. He didn't have a lot of outside interests. He was interested in physics all day long, except on weekends when he would go out with his friends, and they'd go hiking and climbing and fishing, and he'd play tennis. He loved outdoor stuff. He was a very gregarious guy. He wasn't the nerdy scientist. He loved outdoor stuff.
And he was affable, too, wasn't he?
Very affable, very approachable.
Yeah. I mean, I have in mind this sort of brilliant, maybe tense, hard to connect with physicist, right? And you describe a person who is not that at all.
That's right. And that was one of the surprises in the book, actually, is that he inspired this kind of affection because he was such a gregarious and affable person, so easy to approach. You know, he wasn't that interested in stuff other than physics. But, you know, if you were a colleague of his, you fell in love with him.
Yeah. But you know what I also didn't appreciate? Because I think we just take it for granted that we have to win World War II. We got to beat the Germans so the government and corporate America would be on board.
Yes.
Not so. And Fermi was sort of able to sell the concept to DuPont.
DuPont wasn't quite certain that it wanted to get involved with this project. But one of the senior vice presidents of DuPont, a guy named Crawford Greenwald, was there when the pile went critical, and he just thought it was magical, and he just sort of wiped away all the obstacles within DuPont, and DuPont started building the reactors out at Hanford that produced plutonium, and they got deeply involved in the project.
So that begets Hanford and begets Oak Ridge and it begins Los Alamos.
Right.
Did the American people know, and how much did the president or the Congress know we were going to get involved with here?
The president knew everything. Roosevelt knew it all because he had directed it from the beginning. And a very small group of scientists around him knew this as well. But this is one of these amazing projects that it involved hundreds of thousands of people in the end. And I would say only about a couple hundred really knew what the purpose of the project was.
Yeah.
Amazing secrecy. There were people, you know, hundreds of thousands of people involved, and it never leaked. You know, no real stories in the press about it.
Can you imagine us trying to do something like this today?
Impossible.
And maybe
impossible.
We shouldn't be able to do something like this today without some sort of input from the people or their representatives.
Well, that's a very fair point. And, you know, in those days, it was an emergency war footing, and people didn't think in those terms.
I also was reminded in your book how sometimes the scientists themselves were questioned, not trusted, or looked askance at for their accent. Or was it Wigner who didn't remember that his codename was
yes.
Wagner?
Yes.
Like, that's going to fool anybody, right? And then suddenly he's stopped as these are the guys that are going to save America.
That's right. And there a lot of them are immigrants. A lot of them have heavy accents. There's a moment in the book, I'm quoting in the book, I don't mean to offend anyone, but there's a moment when Fermi is introduced to the U.S. Navy by a young officer or young sergeant who says there's a WOP outside. You know, and that's the kind of attitude that people had in those days. But, you know, these are the people who helped win the war. And they were, you know, it's extraordinary. Fermi was an enemy alien for a period of time at the heart of the Manhattan Project. It's just an amazing thing.
Hmm.
You know, in light of what goes on today with immigrants and our attitudes about them, you know, and there's a healthy debate about that, it's important to remember that this group of immigrants were so essential to America's war effort.
I wonder if we have a Fermi today. Who is it, and would we know? Would we appreciate him in our
midst? I think that's a really great question. Physics was much smaller in those days, and the world was much smaller. So when I say he was the last man to know everything, it was possible for a Fermi to do that. I don't think it's possible for a scientist today to know the whole field the way Fermi did. I think there are some brilliant people out there who, you know, are working at places like CERN or working at places like Fermilab or, you know, in the biological sciences or in chemistry or in astrophysics. There are some really, really brilliant people. And, you know, but the interesting question is, who are we missing? Who are the kids out there who don't get the attention that they really deserve and who could grow up to be like Fermi and make huge contributions? Fermi was very lucky that people noticed him when he was a kid. And that saved him and really made his career.
Literally, he wasn't going to get that education, but a friend of the family, was it? Who
exactly.
Took him under his wings and said, I'm going to teach you math and physics.
Exactly. And think of how many kids out there don't have that kind of mentorship. It's, you know, it underscores the importance of mentoring.
Right, because he didn't come from the stock of an Oppenheimer, right?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, there's really no reason to expect that his brilliance would have found such fertile ground, but it did.
Yes.
And the world is the beneficiary.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's not overstating it, is it?
No, I don't think so. I mean, we, you know, we live today with a legacy that he left behind that's really quite amazing.
So then, as we go, tell me something else that you want me to know about Fermi, either an anecdote or just expand a little bit more on who he was.
Well, you know, I think for this, for this audience, I think one of the things they should really know is that he loved Chicago. He absolutely loved it. You know, he came to the United States via New York and spent his first few years at Columbia University. And then he came to Chicago because he was told to by the U.S. government. Spent some time here during the war, then went out to Los Alamos for a year and a half. And when he left Los Alamos, he could have gone anywhere in the world. He could have written a ticket anywhere. He went back to Chicago because he liked it so much. And, you know, he loved the university campus, loved the excitement about it, and really felt a lot of affection for this place.
He died here, did he not?
He died here. He's buried in Oakwood Cemetery, south of the university.
Does he have family members and friends still here?
No, he does not.
Yeah.
His family has dispersed a bit. Actually, I think there's a grandson who is in this area.
Yeah.
But some of his relatives are in England, and some of his relatives are in Canada.
Huh. So. Well, he is always going to be a Chicagoan, and what a great story that David Schwartz has written. It's called The Last Man Who Knew Everything, The Life and Times of Enrico Fermi, the father of the nuclear age. So, you know, my favorite picture in here is where he posed for a picture where he was showing his, yeah. Was it beta decay or
yeah,
whatever,
yeah.
And wrote the formula on a blackboard the way they always do,
yeah.
And he wrote it wrong.
Right, because as a joke. But, you know, I want to say one final thing, which is that, you know, that's one of the only formulas in the book. This is really a book for the general reader.
It is.
I really, really tried to make the science accessible to someone who has no background in physics.
So much so that, you know what I think I'm going to do? I was telling you about my shelves in my house. I'm going to take this off my Manhattan Project shelf, and I'm going to put it on my Chicago shelf. Chicagoans should know this story.
Thank you very much. I really, really appreciate that.